From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. This hour, to mark National Education Week, we look at some of the hot topics in education. In the first half hour, early childhood education. Governor-elect Branstad made no secret of the fact that he does not support Governor Culver's state-funded preschool program for Iowa's four-year-olds. We'll talk with an early childhood education expert about what quality preschool programs look like and where the gaps are in Iowa's system. Then in our second half hour, we examine teacher assessment. How does Iowa judge teacher performance? Is student achievement a good measure of performance? Join our discussion with your thoughts on these issues in education after this news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And this hour, to mark National Education Week, we look at a couple of hot topics in education in our state. In our second half hour, we examine teacher assessment. How does Iowa judge teacher performance? And is student achievement a good measure of performance? Those are the couple of the questions we'll look at in our second half hour. Though, first of all, we want to focus on early childhood education. And my guest to do that is Betty Zahn. She is director of the Regents Center for Early Developmental Education at the University of Northern Iowa, joining us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Cedar Falls. Good afternoon to you, Betty.
Good afternoon, Ben. Thank you.
We want to remind our listeners that Governor-elect Branstad has made no secret of the fact that he does not support Governor Culver's state-funded preschool program for Iowa's four-year-olds. So this half hour, we want to talk with Betty about what quality preschool programs look like and where the gaps are in Iowa's system. And we want our listeners to join in our conversation. What has your experience been in trying to find a preschool for your child? Tell us your story about preschool in Iowa, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Betty, let's start out with the fact that early childhood education has come under the spotlight in recent years. Why?
Well, I think one reason, Ben, is because the research has been so clear that high-quality early childhood education is one of the most effective ways that we can close the achievement gap. And everybody is interested in doing that. It has the potential, the research I've been reading recently says that it has the potential to close somewhere between 30 and 50% of the achievement gap all by itself. And I think when superintendents and school administrators look at that, they want it.
Mm-hmm. So remind us, what is the achievement gap?
Oh, it's the gap that we typically see between children from what you would say upper income homes and children from lower income homes. There is a huge achievement gap. There's also an achievement gap based on race. We see students of color tend to achieve at lower levels than the majority students. And as a nation, we need to address that problem.
Mm-hmm. So what is our best guess about where that achievement gap comes from when it comes to early childhood education? What are the upper levels of income giving their children that the other levels of income perhaps don't?
Well, the research that that I'm talking about shows that when children are in a preschool program where the teacher provides a research-based curriculum, and that is a comprehensive set of experiences and instruction that support all areas of a child's development. So it focuses on children's social development, their cognitive development, language development, all those aspects, that it gives them experiences with developing vocabulary and literacy and familiarity with print and science and math and all in a rich play-based environment where children can have meaningful experiences. They can be curious about the world. They can ask questions and pursue their own answers. that children do better. And we know that in children from higher income families, they get some of those same experiences at home. Mm-hmm. You know, they get a lot of enrichment activities. They get educational toys. They get taken to zoos and parks and museums and all kinds of things. And a lot of children from low-income families don't get those same experiences. And so it falls to preschool to try and make up that gap.
Mm-hmm. So what is going on in the brain? Because some might ask, we have a kindergarten at what, the age of 5 or 6 that begins. What is so important about getting to that brain earlier with the experiences that you just mentioned?
Oh, the brain is so flexible, and children are, you know, children are born. We're all born with all these neurons, and experience gives us synapses, and it connects those neurons in a way. And what we've found, there's been research done in orphanages in Eastern Europe where children were given a very poor level of care and very unstimulating environments. And what you find is that the neurons die off. And so neurologists have done research, you know, doing PET scans of brains of children and comparing them, and the neuronal activity in children who have had deprived environments in the first 5 years of life are much less. It's just phenomenal to see that. So the brain is actually wiring itself in those first 5 years, and that's why the experiences that children have in the first 5 years of life are so critical.
Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like what you're saying is that when we get to that point and we give that person a rich learning environment with all the different areas, that – depending on that, that could become almost a completely different person in 20 years down the road.
Well, that's what the research has shown. I mean, there have been three main studies that have followed children into adulthood and over the last, I'd say, 40 years, maybe 50 years. It started in the 60s. And all three of those studies, although they have had differences among them, have found pretty much the same thing. And that is that children who have exposure to a high-quality early childhood, you know, preschool program, not only do they do better in school, they have lower rates of grade retention, lower rates of placement in special education. So we actually avoid some of the learning problems. They have greater rates of high school graduation and greater rates of college attendance. But then it also has spillover effects into other areas of life. You see lower rates of teen pregnancy, better employment records, greater rates of home ownership, lower rates of juvenile delinquency, lower rates of incarceration. The list just goes on and on. And so the effects extend through adulthood. And at this point, we now have several studies that all show the same thing. So we can't say that, oh, that was just one study.
Mm-hmm. With all this information you're giving me, so it seems crystal clear if I listen to your information. So why isn't everybody on board in terms of the importance, the priority given to early education, if it is as crystal clear as you say it is?
Well, one of the problems, I believe, is that there's so many problems in this. One is that a lot of people still consider preschool to be babysitting, and anyone can babysit. I babysat when I was 12 years old, and I got 50 cents an hour. That dates me. You know, all know what generation I'm from. But there's that lack of valuing of child care and seeing it as just babysitting and not seeing it as a serious profession. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one problem. And another factor, I believe, is that if you really want to provide children with high-quality preschool education, and I have to say those studies that show all those wonderful effects that I just talked about,
right,
they were all extremely high-quality programs. Those programs are expensive. They require well-trained personnel, degreed teachers who not only know how to provide that kind of planned, intentional set of experiences for children, they also know how to systematically observe and monitor and assess children so that they can track their development and make decisions about educational experiences and interventions that are based on those observations. So that takes a highly skilled professional, and It's one of the wonderful things, I think, about the statewide voluntary preschool program that we have here in Iowa now is that by running them through the school districts, the preschool teachers get paid on the same salary schedule. They are degreed. They have specialized training and endorsements in early childhood education. They know how to provide those experiences for children, and they're treated like K-12 teachers, which is what they should be. They should not be earning $7.50 an hour and no benefits.
If you've just joined us, we're marking National Education Week this hour by looking at some of the hot topics in education. In the first half hour, we're talking about early childhood education. My guest, Betty Zahn, director of the Regents Center for Early Developmental Education at the University of Northern Iowa. If you'd like to join our conversation, tell us about the experience you've had in trying to find preschool for your child. What difficulties have you found? What good examples have you found? Or perhaps you just have a question. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. So tell us more about Iowa's early childhood education, preschool, comparing it to other states and even other countries. How do we fit in?
Well, I'd love to start by talking about other countries. In the educational world, we often hear about Finland. Finland leads the world in student achievement. And so I had a chance to talk with a Finnish educator at a conference last year and found out that Finland has universal paid early childhood education from birth for those parents who need it from birth. And it's very, very high quality. So when people ask, well, we should be more like Finland, why aren't we doing things the way Finland does it? Well, that's where you start, is in early childhood education. Currently, Iowa ranks 14th in access to state-funded four-year-old programs, and we rank 29th in state spending for preschool. So we have a ways to go. Some states provide absolutely universal access to preschool education. Oklahoma is number one, and Florida is number two in access. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have a ways to go. Right now, Iowa statewide voluntary preschool programs serve about 21,000 four-year-olds. That's not all of the four-year-olds. So many children are served in private child care. And private childcare doesn't necessarily have a licensed teacher, and you know, if it's licensed, and not all private preschool is licensed or registered, so a lot of the care that children are in here in Iowa is unregulated, completely unregulated, flies under the radar. But those that are registered, their licensing standards really just pertain to health and safety. Because, of course, we want children in healthy, safe environments. But it doesn't address the educational component at all.
Here's an email that addresses just what you were talking about, Betty. This is from Anonymous. I've had two kids go through preschool, writes this listener, one through private nonprofit, the other through a state-run preschool. I can confidently say the money is better spent and maintained by the private organization. What would seem money better spent is vouchers or something for families sending children to preschool, no matter where the preschool is. The other would be the state working to send funding directly to the properly equipped facilities. Your reaction to that email?
You know, I don't want to get into the argument of whether children should be being served in private or public settings. What I want to argue for is that children should be served in high-quality settings where there are qualified teachers who know about child development and know how to support that development. Now, the statewide voluntary preschool programs are required to collaborate with the providers in the communities. And so one of the things that can happen is that the quality of these private centers that are collaborating with the school districts can come up because a licensed teacher can be placed in those centers. And actually, that may be the best of all possible worlds because that way children can have continuity of care. You know, maybe they have a two-year-old sibling and they both go to the same center so that the four-year-old can be served at that center and can have full-day care without having to be moved from one place to another.
1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org to join our conversation about early childhood education this half hour, in the next half hour, teacher assessment. Before we go back to the phones, let's talk about Governor Culver's preschool program. What did Governor Culver's program do that wasn't being done before?
Well, the program provided funding to school districts that flows directly into school districts so that schools can collaborate with their community partners, be they faith-based, Head Start, whatever, and then they can provide services for four-year-olds. There's a minimum of 10 hours per week that they are to provide services, although it can be more than that. And they have to adhere to a set of standards. And I think this is one of the things that I was getting at, the difference between private child care and the preschool programs, is that the preschool programs that receive state dollars have to adhere to two sets of standards. One is performance standards that assure that they are providing a quality program. They can adhere to the Iowa Quality Preschool Program standards, or they can achieve national accreditation from the National Association for the Education of Young Children, which is a very rigorous accreditation system, or they can adhere to the Head Start performance standards. So they have choices, but all three of those sets of performance standards make sure that the programs are of a high quality. They also have to show that they are addressing the Iowa Early Learning Standards, which address the child's developmental and intellectual needs.
A lot of details there, and I don't want to let our time get away. Very interesting, Betty. I want to ask you quickly before we go back to the phones. If this program is defunded, what will happen to those programs quickly?
I don't know. I mean, the money is already funneling into the school districts. The school districts have created partnerships. If the money goes away, I imagine those children are not going to be served.
Okay, let's go to Tara in Coralville, 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Tara, what's on your mind when you hear this conversation?
Oh, I'm just really excited to hear that this is being brought up as an important topic of discussion. I have two preschoolers myself, and we happen to fall into an income bracket where we can't afford private preschool. We also don't qualify for publicly funded programs. But I have found, as a person keeping my kids home from preschool, that we have a lot of really great opportunities in the community, particularly at the public libraries. And I really appreciate that as a parent, that I can tap into those kinds of resources. And also, like, at the rec center, we also have some opportunities of programs that are designed with those same goals in mind that the preschool programs might have for children that have more opportunities.
Tara, good point there. Let me ask our guest, Betty Zan, about this middle bracket. So you're not able to qualify for the low-income help, and you're not able to pay for the expensive higher end of things. Do you find that often, that there's a gap in the middle of people unable to?
Absolutely, and I'm so glad that she called, because that's a really important point. Upper income families can afford to go out and find the best possible care and pay whatever it costs. Families that earn less than the poverty level can qualify for Head Start, and we hope they can get on a waiting list and have their children served by Head Start. But there is a vast number of families in the middle for whom they don't have those options. And the child care that they can afford is mere custodial care. The children, we hope, are safe and healthy, but they may not be receiving the best educational program they could be getting.
That stimulation to the brain that you said was so important and described earlier in the program. Mona is with us, also from Coralville. Mona, good afternoon. Welcome to our program.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Sure. What's on your mind, Mona?
No, I'm calling because I'm a believer in what Betty is saying. I think it's going to be a travesty if this particular program is going to be eliminated from Iowa. There's a huge disparity. I've seen it when I taught in New York City in the Bronx with a class of 30, maybe one or two have had the wonderful experience of a Head Start program or early childhood experience. And you can see that they're well assimilated, they're well behaved, they understand what to do in the classroom, they understand how to gather knowledge, how to go for more, and the ones that don't, it's too late. It's too late for them. The bigger they get, it's too late. It sets parents, I think, when kids are smaller, it sets parents like, hey, education does make a difference. It will make a difference. You just have to start when they're really little. Get them when they're little. They're sponges. We all know this.
Mm.
We understand. I have two boys, and I have put them through early childhood preschools, and it has made a difference for them, and I can see the difference. And I think that if we choose not to defund this program, I think you're going to see a lot more problems. And Betty has listed them all out. You're going to see them in pregnancy. You're going to see them in drugs. You're going to see them in crimes and not challenging the mind. How about that?
Okay, Mona, we got the point. We have just a few minutes left. Thank you, Mona, for that point of view from Coralville. Let's go to Pete in Clive. Pete, what's on your mind? Do you agree with all this?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First of all, let me say I agree completely I support and I believe that early education makes the difference that your guest says it does. I guess my frustration is that I can click the dial on the radio one notch, and I'll hear just as impassioned an argument for basically what we're talking about is funding, money.
Right, priorities.
Any of a thousand other good priorities. So, where does it end? Whose hand do we put this money in? And where does this money come from? My tax dollars, your tax dollars. So it's frustrating, and I hear the argument, but I think there are too many hands out. And I don't believe we can fund it all. So
Pete,
there you go.
Thank you for bringing up that skeptical point, Pete from Clive. Let's talk about that, this argument, not only that there are other places to fund. We've got the state's limited resources. Some say make the argument that we need to fund K through 12 fully as well as we can. We can't really afford this preschool. What do you make of that, Betty?
Well, Ben, first of all, I have to suggest that somebody look at the research on the return on investment of early childhood education. And to do that, you can go to the website of the National Institute for Early Education Research. That's www.nieer.org. They have it all laid out. An economist, Nobel Prize-winning economist James Heckman has written a paper about the importance of investing in early childhood. The return on investment for early childhood is huge. I've seen up to like $38 for every dollar spent. I mean, we can't pass up those kinds of opportunities. It's kind of a matter of, do we spend it on preschool education now or do we spend it on prisons later? So I think it's very clear that this is a high priority. You can also go to the web and see what police chiefs have to say about early childhood. There's a whole website of police chiefs saying we need more early childhood programs. This prevents crime. And if you think about the cost of crime in this society, who wouldn't want to do that?
Betty Zahn, thank you for joining us this half hour. We've run out of time. Director of the Regents Center for Early Developmental Education at the University of Northern Iowa. Thank you, Betty.
Thank you, Ben.
And when we come back, we want to talk about teacher assessment in this mark of National Education Week when we come back. Molly Boyle is one of the guests we'll have on, recently named Iowa Teacher of the Year for 2011. Education, our topic. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News.
Three is a magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number. Somewhere in the ancient mystic trinity, you get three as a magic number. The past and the present and the future, faith and hope and charity, the heart and the brain and the body give you three as a magic number.
So nice to have you with us over the noon hour. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Earlier this week, the Food and Drug Administration determined it's not safe to add caffeine to alcohol. The FDA commissioner says drinks such as 4 Loko, which are popular among college students, can lead to a state of wide awake drunk. Tomorrow on this program, we'll talk about the effects of caffeine and alcohol on the brain, and with officials from the Iowa Alcoholic Beverages Division about what the FDA's decision means for the drinks here in Iowa. That's The Exchange tomorrow, Friday, over the noon hour. This hour, to mark National Education Week, we're looking at a couple of hot topics in education. The first half hour, we focused on early childhood education, and now we want to examine teacher assessment. Joining me to do that, Molly Boyle, recently named Iowa Teacher of the Year for 2011. She's a third grade teacher at Brookview Elementary in Waukee. Congratulations and welcome to our program, Molly Boyle.
Thank you.
And also joining us, Nadine Davidson, interim head of the Department of Teaching at the University of Northern Iowa, and Barry Wilson, associate professor of educational psychology and foundations and director of assessment at the University of Northern Iowa. Nadine and Barry, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben.
Good afternoon, Ben.
And we want to reach out to our listeners for this half hour as we talk about teacher assessment. Parents, how do you judge whether your child has an effective teacher? What do you want to see in your child or your child's classroom that demonstrates an effective teacher? Tell us your story this half hour that has to do with teacher assessment. 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Molly Boyle, Iowa Teacher of the Year for 2011. I think your term starts in January. Is that right?
That is correct.
Must be looking forward to that. Tell us, how are you assessed in the classroom?
It's on a cycle, a three-year cycle when we are formally assessed. I will say I'm pretty fortunate. I have a very good administrator who's present pretty consistently, dropping in here and there, which I think holds all teachers to a higher standard. You just don't know when he's going to come through, but we are required to formally be assessed on that three-year cycle.
Okay, you mean every 3 years? Is that the three-year cycle? Then what happens? Does your administrator come in? What exactly happens? Walk us through that.
Well, let me back up just a minute, because my background is I was out of the classroom for 6 years, and last year was my first year returning back. And due to the cycle I was on, a formal evaluation year would require you to do some pre-observation planning and meeting with an administrator. I haven't had to do that yet. So you're talking to someone who hasn't been through this process for quite some time. As far as I know, my year where I will be formally assessed as a teacher will come next year when I return back to the classroom. But in my past experience, when I have gone through that cycle, you do present to your principal what you want to be evaluated on as far as it relates to the Iowa teaching standards, mm-hmm. and what they will hopefully see as a result of your plan lesson. In Waukee, we do use what's called the Danielson framework, and it's a set of criteria. And the thing I like about that criteria is it gives you projections for what would an effective teacher look like within the standard and what would an ineffective teacher look like. And so you can use that to kind of guide your decision making and also reflect on, okay, when I teach, how close was I to that exceed standard, which I hope all teachers are striving for.
Molly Boyle, Iowa Teacher of the Year for 2011, third grade teacher at Brookview Elementary in Waukee. Now, you're joining us from Brookview, aren't
you?
Yes, you are. I hear some goings on in the background, and I know we have to let you go in a very few minutes to get back to your work there at the elementary school in Waukee. Tell us, you are obviously a great teacher and have been identified as such. What would you say are the keys to being a great teacher?
Wow, there's lots of things. Like I said to parents last night, we've been having parent-teacher conferences this week, and so we are talking about the day-to-day assessment of kids' learning, and for me, every decision I make is based on what I see the kids doing today. And so as far as assessment guiding my instructional decisions, 100% of the time, and a lot of times those assessments are often made on the spot. If my lesson plan is showing me that four kids aren't getting it, even if I had planned to meet with another group of kids today, if that need is more pertinent, those four kids that were demonstrating they didn't understand or weren't competent are going to be pulled aside and worked within a smaller group, presented the information in a different way. For me, assessment is going on every second of every day with these kids.
Mm-hmm. So that's part of being a great teacher, is that you've got your finger on the pulse of what each student is achieving, comprehending, understanding. How much of student achievement should be part of the evaluation for your job performance. You have 20. You have 20 kids. How much should that play a role when they say how your students are stacking up according to other students?
That is a tricky, tricky question. My husband is also an educator, and a couple weeks ago I was reading an article in the Des Moines Register regarding that question, and I have such mixed feelings about that because there are so many variables that go into how much a student is going to achieve. What I would tell you I feel best about is from where the student began to when they leave me, and then looking at multiple measures, not just one test, have they progressed and have they met my expectations? Have they met their own expectations? Even third grade, my kids are 8 and 9 years old, but they have independently self-selected goals in math, reading, writing, behavior. And then I also give them my perception of what I feel they need to do to progress as a learner. Those are the kinds of things that I want to see growth in. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know how anyone can think that a teacher's performance could be based on student achievement alone, because there are so many things that factor into that. And then, again, every class is different.
Okay.
And I just don't know how fairly teachers could be judged by that.
Molly Boyle, Iowa Teacher of the Year for 2011. Hang on if you can. Mm-hmm. Do you have to go yet?
No,
okay.
They're doing
okay.
Fine.
We've got a few minutes. Please.
I've done a pretty good job teaching them routines and procedures because they're still all actively engaged as far as I can see in what they should be doing.
Okay. Very good, Molly Boyle. Let's turn to Nadine Davidson and Barry Wilson at the University of Northern Iowa. Let's talk about the current assessment right now, and I'm not sure which of this to pitch to, so I'll let you decide that. Tell us how teachers are currently assessed in Iowa schools.
Well, Iowa's teachers are assessed based on the 8 Iowa teaching standards and the 42 criteria, and I think this is what Molly referenced as she talked about the teaching cycle. That varies and may vary a little bit depending upon the individual school, but if we want to look at our new teachers that leave higher ed and are in their first and second and sometimes third year of teaching, they are evaluated where they need to show and demonstrate to their particular administrator that they can meet the 8 Iowa teaching standards and 42 criteria. And that can be done in a variety of ways. It may be based on observations by the administrator. It may be based on samples of lesson plans or tests or assessments that they have used. It may show various documents of how they've continued their professional growth. So that's the basic framework that our existing teachers in the field is used to evaluate our existing teachers.
Mm-hmm. Those are the criteria. Who judges? Who looks at those criteria?
The criteria are established by the state. In fact, I think they may be even in code. They're established, and so the teachers and the administrator and their mentor would look and talk about what would be appropriate ways to determine whether that individual teacher has met that criteria.
And as we discussed with Molly Boyle, student achievement, what part does that play in our performance assessment?
In terms of the current 8 Iowa teaching standards and whether students are performing as a classroom, student learning is certainly a piece in the 8 Iowa teaching standards. Looking at the 1 standardized score isn't necessarily factored into that, but student learning is the focus of the overall teaching process and teaching event. And so that would be, evident through how they are showing that they have met those teaching standards and criteria.
Nadine Davidson is with us, interim head of the Department of Teaching at the University of Northern Iowa. Barry Wilson, also of UNI, with us. Molly Boyle, recently named Iowa Teacher of the Year for 2011 at Brookview Elementary in Waukee, joining us this half hour. We want to get your input, listeners. What has been your experience? How do you judge whether your child has an effective teacher? What do you want to see in your child or your child's classroom that demonstrates an effective teacher? Tell us your story, 1-866-780-9100, the exchange at iowapublicradio.org, or email. Also on Twitter at IPR Talk. And Barry Wilson, you, I understand, are involved in assessing teachers before they graduate from the University of Northern Iowa and go into classrooms, correct?
Yes, that's right, Ben.
How do we predict when a teacher leaves college whether he or she will be successful in the classroom?
Well, I think our best evidence is actually what they can do in terms of impacting student learning. And so one of the things that has been a hallmark of teacher preparation in Iowa, and I can say that this is true of all of our Iowa institutions, that we're required to assess our student teachers and teachers in preparation in a way that documents that they can produce student learning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't necessarily mean a focus in terms of a test score, but actually, given a unit that you've taught, what evidence can you present that demonstrates that you had an impact? And so certainly that notion of teacher effectiveness being defined in terms of student achievement is very strong.
Mm-hmm. We know that Molly Boyle has to leave us and get back to her work at Brookview Elementary in Waukee. So I want to break in here and go back to Molly quickly and say, Molly, congratulations again on this honor, Iowa Teacher of the Year in 2011. Briefly, do you have a message you want to get across in your tenure as Iowa Teacher of the Year? What would you want to get across in the year 2011?
There are several.
Give us one.
That's my job come January 1 is to fine-tune that, because as I'm listening to the conversation happening today and looking around my classroom and kind of just thinking, what's my next step once I get off the phone and go back to the kids, one of the things we talked about in my classroom this morning was the ability to articulate your understanding. And so one of the things I think as teachers we need to make sure that we can do is, if we are truly assessing our kids day by day and intentionally planning new learning experiences for them, we need to be able to articulate for ourselves first and foremost, and also articulate to our kids what it is that we saw today that impacts why we're doing what we're going to do tomorrow.
Mm.
And when I was asked my interview questions to be selected as Iowa Teacher of the Year, that was one of the words I used to describe myself as a teacher. And that's one of the things I hope to teach my kids to do, is be reflective of yourself as a learner, as an individual, and each day set a new goal for yourself as a learner. And I think as teachers, we really need to question ourselves and say, why am I doing this? What evidence have my kids shown me that they need to be doing this today? And being willing to change the way we've always done things as a result of that reflection.
Molly Boyle, we wish you continued success and that continued passion we hear in your voice for many years to come. Thank you, Molly.
Well, thank you.
All right.
Have a good afternoon.
You too. Bye-bye now. Molly Boyle, recently named Iowa Teacher of the Year. Barry Wilson, I wanted to follow up with you and ask this sort of basic question. To what degree are good teachers born versus made? We have naturally gifted athletes, for example, naturally gifted communicators. When people show up without being instructed on how to be a teacher, do you already know pretty well? Can you assess? Are they going to be a good teacher?
I guess if I had to respond, I'd say it's obviously a combination of things. The qualities that make you a person come from birth on. And yet at the same time, there's always something to build on. So born, made, I think we first of all, the people who want to become teachers have been affected by teachers themselves and see in themselves some of the talents, some of the characteristics that they think would make them a good teacher. So we get kind of a select group who come to us, and basically our mission is to build on that foundation and in the process determine whether you've got what it takes.
Are there tools that you think need to be developed in the future, Nadine and Barry, that you can need to be developed in order to better assess whether teachers are effective?
Well, I think we're involved in a process right now to kind of look at that. You asked the question you just asked Barry on, are teachers made or are they born with certain qualities? I think we're in the process right now of working to define what we're calling the characteristics of effective teaching or effective instruction. And do we have that, a good grasp of that? And there are some discussions even on the national level coming from work with the American Association of Colleges for Teacher Education, AACTE, and the Council of Chief State School Officers that are looking at what is effective instruction, what is effective teaching, and how will we go about measuring that. And so as we're looking at what are those emerging qualities or characteristics, and then what can we do to assess that? And so we're in that process right now of looking at what that could mean, and the complexity and how to assess those pieces through a performance of that prospective teacher or the practicing teacher.
I wanted to bring up a recent Des Moines Register editorial that asked this question. Given that Iowa's public schools have added nearly 1,000 full-time teaching positions over the past 5 years, and given that statewide enrollment has fallen by more than 9,000 students in that same time period, why didn't achievement jump in that time period, asks the Des Moines Register editorial. What is your response to that?
Well, I guess I would respond in terms of just declining enrollment, which we've had in Iowa for quite some time. And when enrollment declines, it tends to be uneven, and it doesn't automatically result in, reallocating resources or using those resources with great precision in that reallocation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a set of things that come with declining enrollments that don't make that an easy task.
So it's not as easy to say we have 1,000 more full-time teachers, we have fewer students, why aren't we having a real jump in achievement? We can't think about it that way? Or that result will be in years to come once it is better aligned?
Well, I think over time those things can even out, particularly as you think about reorganization of districts and reallocation within schools and closing of schools and so on. But if you have two schools and they both have 40 students total and then they reduce to 30, a superintendent is faced with a difficult decision in terms of, do I close one school or make one grade? And it's hard to determine exactly where that point of collapse should be made in terms of the organizational structure.
The Los Angeles Times earlier this year decided to publish an evaluation of teacher effectiveness. What do you think of that decision? Should the public have access to information about teacher performance? Should that find its way into our newspapers, onto our airwaves?
I guess I think the thing that surprised me about that event was, first of all, that they did that, because I think that also was accompanied by rank ordering teachers and from low to high in terms of test scores, without any consideration of what they teach or where they teach or the conditions under which they teach. But I think the thing that was interesting to me as well was the fact that many of the teachers said, well, if that's good information, why wasn't the information shared with me? Because I do want to improve. And that's the thing that I see among teachers that I know teach. They want to become better. They're thirsty for information that helps improve. And I think providing good information to teachers in terms of that constant improvement is something that we're striving to improve on, and I think we'll get there.
Just a minute or so left. Iowa is traditionally known as a place with quality public schools. How is that reputation holding up when we do comparisons, especially given the bad economy?
Well, I think currently we're totally focused in terms of outputs, in terms of making comparisons. So even in terms of our No Child Left Behind, we compare schools in terms of test scores and who's proficient and who's not. And without also asking what are the conditions that support education in general and families and children and so I think it's a situation in which we have to look not just at one thing, test scores, for example, but have to consider the bigger picture in terms of multiple measures. I thought Molly made a great point in terms of assessing how we're doing, whether it's a teacher or whether we're looking at education generally. We need to have multiple measures and multiple perspectives and make sure the process is fair.
Okay, we want to thank you very much for joining us this half hour. Barry Wilson, Associate Professor of Educational Psychology and Foundations, Director of Assessments at the University of Northern Iowa. Nadine Davidson, Interim Head of the Department of Teaching at the University of Northern Iowa. Thank you for making the effort to come to our studio.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
And The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Cedar Falls, we had help from Phil Moss. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Two times.